live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Normally, I would start with health and nutrition and healing information, then environmental issues, a guest, commentary, and then talk back where people have a chance to share insights. Today, however, due to the president's announcement about gun control, also due to an interview with Alex Jones and Pierce Morgan on CNN on Monday night, and a subsequent interview, I believe it was yesterday, with Huffington Post, I've decided to revamp my program and begin with an original commentary by myself and Richard Gale. And we've worked hours on this to try to understand what we're really dealing with, to go beyond the partisan politics. Also, following this, I have put together some of the more salient points made by Alex Jones in a historical context. And what I feel we need at this moment is to pull back from the intensity, veracity, anger by which someone is expressing themselves and focus upon what they're saying. Does it align with our principles or challenge them? Unfortunately, too often in America, when someone gets angry, we immediately detach from what they're saying, irrespective of whether or not they're telling us something we need to hear and is honest. Just the manner of the presentation can be offsetting. That's how Howard Dean, a man who had extreme principles and was truly a populist and would have demanded and not compromised on a single-payer health care program and other principles, and was against war in Iraq and Afghanistan, why he was thrown under the bus by the corporate Democrats. His temperament was too volatile. Alex Jones has an extremely volatile temperament, but I suggest that much of what he has to say is accurate, honest, and important. It does not mean you have to agree with everything. And clearly that's not the case, similarly with Ron Paul. But I want to have you hear it, not in the anger he's expressing himself, but in the need to force these discussions that are not getting any attention. That said, let us begin. I believe we have to look at all reasonable causes of violence. The mass shootings at America's schools and colleges and shopping malls and even the theater and the Sheikh temple unleashes a psychological terror that reminds us that murder can happen anywhere. One of the most urgent questions is to decide which discussion we should be having. Should discussions be limited to access to assault weapons, an apparent American preference for mass shootings, or do we focus on the ease in obtaining a weapon without mental health screening? Or is it possible that the actual violence is far more pernicious and systemic? And are we willing to acknowledge and confront any of this? Could it be that the most overt forms of violence that occur in our backyards draw our attention and demand immediate dialogue? If this is so, then is it even worth considering the inability of the U.S. to shed a tear or demand a public outcry for the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Native people in the United States, probably upwards of 10 to 20 million, nor confess to the abysmal treatment of minority groups, especially African Americans and Latinos, throughout our culture and history, even today? And where is the national remorse for the estimated 3.8 million Vietnamese killed by Americans in a war mindset, always by the best and brightest? Remember McNamara and Robert and John F. Kennedy, the Ivy Leaguers, those who had the pedigree of perfection, the good manners, the good names, the good everything, except no spiritual values. And by the way, those figures of 3.8 million are new figures in the British Medical Journal. And what about the 300,000 to 500,000 Cambodians, innocent of anything, and those in Laos, killed during the indiscriminate bombing under Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon? Would Americans have been equally outraged and be demanding gun control if the carnage had not occurred in the prosperous community of Sandy Hook School in Newton Township in Connecticut, but it happened in Camden, New Jersey, or South Central Los Angeles, or a ghetto in Detroit? Shootings happen there every day, as do rapes, muggings. Do we hear about it? Never. As a nation, we are capable of separating out the means of violence, meaning guns, from the underlying cause of violence. I think not. There'll be rare a discussion on the actual causes of violence. It will all focus upon the type of guns and ammunition, and who should have a right to buy them. Violence is a highly lucrative and intoxicating progenitor of the American lifestyle. It permeates our culture, such as mixed martial arts fighting, video games, and comic books, all glorifying combat, violence, war, and murder. Verbal abuse and emotional taunting are perceived as crowning achievements of reality television, when normal everyday event can be transformed into a cruel spectacle in order to entertain viewers. What does it tell us about we, the people? Each of these examples share an anticipation and provocation through threatening actions, ridiculing, and mocking words, all leading up to emotional and physical violence. Why are we not shocked by the large number of children who are physically abused and die every day without guns being used? Or how many kids miss school because of bullying and intimidation every day? Or the epidemic of spousal abuse without guns? When was the last time a national debate in Congress or in the churches and temples and synagogues took place to question the legitimacy of hundreds of thousands of dead men, women, and children and the elderly due to America's incursions into Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan and Libya and Yemen? Where do we see their faces, their bodies? We do not. They are sanitized from the American consciousness and psyche. After all, we don't want the Americans seeing the truth of our actions as we had in Vietnam, because it would turn the public against these needed, necessary, good wars. If we're not willing to examine each of these militaristic intrusions, then can we understand the true cause of individual acts of violence, such as mass killings of innocents on a school campus? What does it tell us about ourselves that The Hunger Games is one of the top-grossing films of 2012? The film was about kids killing kids, all for the pleasure and delight of young and old alike. Today, anything enacted in the name of nationalism or patriotism in defense of our biases and prejudices is considered normal and worthy of praise. The consequences of this illogical psychology then qualifies us to believe that we are an exceptional people, a culture second to none, such as, well, we've heard it so many times. This unearned exceptionalism, accompanied by a false sense of entitlement, is an illusion rapidly coursing through our population and especially surging among the younger generation. What is rarely discussed are the consequences of poverty, inequality, and fractured family life, because the overarching ideal of American elitism has turned into an extension of the biases, prejudice, and hatred towards those lower down the social ladder. This has resulted in the codification and commodification of dysfunction and moral decay now embodied by these special interest groups. Today, dysfunction is a necessary advantage in a typical American corporate's strategy. For example, the psychiatric drugs that are now institutionalized across all social and economic levels are known to have the same adverse effects of mania, hallucination, psychosis, violence, and a higher risk of homicide and suicide that has been shown to be a common characteristic in the demented personalities of nearly all of the mass shooters. So what was it? The psychiatric drugs? The artificial diagnosis of people who don't sit still in class, that somehow they have a authority defiance disorder if they speak out and should be medicated? But what if this is just an extension of free will? What if this is an extension of being bored in class? What if it's an extension of coming to school hyped on caffeine, amphetamines? But we take no responsibility for this because it does not fit neatly into our basic dialogue. If we begin to stand back and take in all these pieces and then ask if they fit into a realistic portrait of the new American psyche, then it is highly likely we will see the real nature of what the country has become and worst, what it is morphing into. After every school or community shooting, we attempt to identify and rationalize the threat. We demonize it and then finally struggle to have the menace surgically removed by legislative decree. We are willing to sacrifice some of our freedoms and give permission to the powerful to rule over more of our lives in order to feel better protected. Increase the number of school guards. Arm all teachers. Intensify stricter rules and discipline over students. Make everyone take a mental health test. Is that the answer? To become an armed camp? Then you must, by extension, you must have armed guards in every stadium for every sporting event, in every stadium for every entertainment event, in every movie theater, in every church, synagogue, and temple. Everywhere where you have more than two people, you have to have an armed guard. Well, that's just fine with the private industries that would love to supply the guards at $500 an hour per guard. That's the insanity of the current mindset, which rots from the top down. The truth of the matter is that our values and moral bearings are not honored. Most Americans believe that possession of the world's most powerful military force gives us the mandate, an absolute right to use it for any purpose that strengthens our national power and corporate interest. Cost of human life is never calculated into the equation. This merciless power has been officially codified into the Patriot Act under Bush and then further expanded by Obama in the National Defense Authorization Act. We train young, impressionable minds and transform them into bullies. A grotesque alpha dominant standard for both genders, believing in a personal manifest destiny, has become the new ideal to strive for. There is no outcry that America's forces are now present in over 130 countries around the world to champion a democracy and freedom that is absent in our homeland. And this grand illusion, in Chris Hedges' words, is America's celebration of power. The recent analysis of the American Freshman Survey, a 47-year survey of college freshmen's perceptions of themselves compared to their peers, notes an alarming increase in narcissistic attributes among young adults, exaggerated perceptions about themselves and their skills that don't match their real abilities, inflated ambition status, unrealistic expectations, and self-centeredness lacking humility. What the study failed to explore is the high degree of competition between young people, which motivates them to battle and defeat others in order to achieve naive aspirations. And this is why so many in the younger generation have been consistently criticized for their demands of believing they are entitled to everything, while conversely resenting anyone, any institution, any belief, or any value that threatens their vacuous existence. Consider the American power structure and the great efforts people undertake to attain power, acquire wealth, and rise to celebrity status. The drive for power and wealth blinds us to what brings true happiness and its superior gifts. Those we receive when we care and show compassion towards others. Since we live in a corporate culture wherein we are desensitized from life's vitality by the social medias, everything and everyone outside our inner circle are no more than innate objects. Therefore, there should be little wonder why people have the urge to escape normal feelings and find relief in virtual relationships on Facebook or Twitter, or in mood-altering medications or drugs or alcohol. Our society has mutated into a mind-numbing toxic plasma. It has become itself a drug that desensitizes our youth because violence is among the best-selling commodities for a consumer youth-based entertainment economy. And among our most successful exporters driving the gross domestic product are the private military-industrial complex, the poisons unleashed by the pharmaceutical and agro industries, and the financial industry that keeps the machine greased and rolling. How many citizens can honestly admit they feel outraged towards their nation's crimes against humanity, which has cost millions of children's lives across the Middle East and other nations who don't buy into the Washington consensus? What does it tell us when President Clinton's Secretary of State, with the full knowledge and acceptance of Hillary and Bill Clinton sitting in power, can tell the American people over 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl that the price of the deaths of 500,000 young, innocent children due to the United States' sanctions against Iraq were worth it? This form of violence against the innocents would be genocide by any other humanitarian standard. However, today this is permitted because it is a new norm of U.S. foreign policy and is again being repeated with sanctions against Iran. Do you really think that the Ayatollahs, do you really think that their top guards and their unique and elite people will suffer because of sanctions? No. They will not be the ones who suffer because of lack of the medicines they need. It is the poorest, the least among them, in power and fortune that will suffer. And once again, we will have a Secretary of State, if it is the less than benign Kerry, who will say, it was worth it. Really? What if it was your child? We have desensitized ourselves from a decade of indiscriminate bombing ventures across Afghanistan and Iraq and drone warfares, and decades of playing possum in order to avoid our personal role and responsibility for the world's largest concentration camp, better known as Gaza. When 250,000 Indian farmers committed suicide in the last decade, frequently by drinking the pesticide Roundup, is this not an act of escape from the violence perpetrated upon them by a heartless agrochemical industry solely concerned with seed and pesticide sales? One example is Monsanto, who would never shed a tear for numerous dead farmers who were motivated to purchase seeds that ended up destroying themselves and their families. On the other hand, what would happen if 250,000 of America's top corporate executives committed suicide by drinking Roundup in their Wall Street offices? Do you think that would go unnoticed? I think not. Would that call for emergency national dialogue? I think it would. Buried beneath the gun control debate is our collective national denial about America's moral decay. We need to wake up to the fact that much of our culture is cruel and violent. Not all, but much. And we are exporting this violent temperament globally. It is one of the few manufactured commodity America has left. America is a nation built upon the right to gun ownership. In and of it themselves, we should not believe guns are the only and primary cause of violence. It is simply too simplistic, and it is untrue. If it were true that owning guns was the fundamental cause of mass shootings, then Switzerland, the world's fourth largest gun-owning nation, would have comparable homicide and crime rates. They do not. But for many social and regulatory factors that the Swiss understand and America's intentionally ignored, there is no evidence this is the case. The Swiss do not engage in a fruitless war on drugs at huge expense to taxpayers that is extremely violent, but are highly profitable for corporate vultures running the privatized prison system. For years, the Swiss have forgiven drug use and prostitution in order to reduce unwanted elements associated with violent crime. Unlike the United States, Switzerland doesn't have 1 in 4 children under the age of 6 living in dire poverty, nor are 12% of Swiss children and teens taking psychiatric drugs for conditions that are non-existent. Instead, Switzerland boasts one of the highest standards of living and health in the world, with greater economic equality than the GINI ratings than does the United States. And equally important, Switzerland prevents citizens with past or present mental conditions from purchasing firearms. It is time for the U.S. to be honest with itself. People with violent dispositions pull triggers. So do people who have been victims of abuse and compulsive acts of violence against them. And then they can perpetuate that. And this becomes a fundamentally cruel, callous effort. Before arguing about the role of guns in crime, homicides, and suicides, we must first ask and accept the issue. Are we becoming a violent nation? And ask, why is our culture so cruel? Similar to most medications, it is easier to treat the symptoms than cure disease. For that reason, drawing a red line between those who fight for the right to keep their guns and those who yearn to enforce laws to take them away misses, in my opinion, the most serious issue and is completely non-constructive. So from my perspective, what are the actual forms of violence that characterize America as a deranged culture? Let us begin with the rise of gangs. According to the National Gang Intelligence Center, between 48% to 90% of violent crimes in the United States is gang-related, both at the state and local jurisdictions where gang activity is prominent. As of 2011, there were 33,000 different gangs in the United States, representing a minimum of 1.4 million members. This number will increase substantially if the country pursues its current economic, social, and restructuring and domestic policy trajectory. In large part, the war on drugs and progressive court rulings have contributed to the upsurge in gang membership. Gun prohibition will only reproduce the failures of past historical prohibitions that strengthen crime syndicates and gangs. It is therefore wise to ask ourselves a serious question posed by philosopher John Cozy. Do you really believe that gun control will miraculously make America into a tranquil nation? There are many reasons behind the escalating growth in gang membership, including abject poverty, fractured and dysfunctional families, bullying and the fear of injury, domestic abuse and violence, city and police harassment in lower-income neighborhoods, the dismal failures of the war on drugs, and miserable, underfunded school systems. Gangs serve as an extension of the protected family in ways where American society has failed. A boy who joins a gang will be capable of supporting family members with food, clothing, and a roof over their heads. Gang membership empowers youth. They are respected because they are feared, and no longer will they be bullied, but can be the bully. But in return, the boy must undergo a thorough initiation, usually by committing a violent act, to become a worthy member of this new family. Gangs will remain a significant feature in American culture as long as no effort is made to de-ghettoizing our bleakest neighborhoods. After the 2008 financial meltdown, over 50 million Americans either lost their homes or are underwater in their mortgage payments. A neighborhood with an inordinate number of empty houses decreased the value of those occupied. The consequence is that the ghetto has now reached the suburbs. Imagine being a 15-year-old, awakening in the morning by a marshal or a law enforcement officer at your door, there to evict your family from your home, and you have nowhere to go. For a teenager, there is the humiliation going to school and knowing you are among the poorest of the poor now. There's a social isolation and denigration. A gang offers more than government social services projects. This scenario is well known by sociologists. But the elite refused to pay heed. Why didn't the president execute a moratorium on home foreclosures or force too-big-to-fail banks to reduce homeowners' payments to the actual value of the property and forgive the rest and suspend interest payments and forgive them? Why didn't we do any of this, but we don't want to look at this kind of institutionalized violence against families, nor discuss the growing income disparity and low wages and rising cost of the essentials to live as contributors to violence. That we're not willing to do. According to all the latest information that I have, we must also look at violence as entertainment. Violence is one of the most popular pastimes. The multimedia, entertainment, and video gaming industries capitalize on a vicious assault upon the senses of youth and adults alike. The Department of Defense surely doesn't mind. It applauds the popularity of video games such as Gear of War, Soldier of Fortune, and Call of Duty because they desensitize our children, reshaping them into easy prey for future military recruiters. And if that is not enough, especially after 9/11, we have witnessed the Pentagon strengthening its collaboration with Hollywood to fund nationalistic propaganda on the big screen. Boys can be further bullied through images that distort the virtues of honor and integrity to serve an imperialist agenda. It is an illusion, a grand betrayal, that is now well known to numerous traumatized veterans who have returned from the killing fields in Iraq and Afghanistan. Let us look now also at America's prisons as gulags of violence. Another way violence is being reinforced in our society is through a privatized prison system that is completely dependent upon rising crime rates for its future profits. Through the detention industry's lobbying efforts, violence is a lucrative asset. American prisons are nothing but gulags that further incubate and unleash violence. They serve no other purpose. Rape and assault are endemic. Judges, lawyers, and state legislatures all know this all too well, but permit this violence to continue unrestricted in order not to upset the private entrepreneurs controlling the system or the moralists who believe that anything that happens to you in a prison system you deserve. License for violence spreads like a virus. More incarceration means more financial incentives for state and local authorities to bully citizens. Police departments have been militarized and now collaborate closely with our military services. They have been turned into hives of legalized thuggery. The rights of citizens are abused and the preservation of civility and community well-being is undermined. For example, the stop and search program of the New York City Police Department has victimized hundreds of thousands of citizens, mostly men and women of color, each year. As a result, many have been illegally harassed and arrested for crimes never committed. Then we have violence of dogmatic faith. Even religion has been infiltrated by our culture of cruelty. At one time, most religious faiths advocated love and compassion over hatred and violence. That was when religion was more relevant and believable, and contributed constructively to educating children with higher ideals of respect and tolerance towards multi-ethnic and multicultural diversity. Today, along the pavements of Main Street, many American churches have morphed into Christian madrasas, communities of dogmatic cruelty and abuse. The gospel has been reinterpreted in some to mandate the rule of the rod. Jesus is then transfigured into a cosmic warrior leading America's crusades under a banner of hatred towards all who do not bow down to its ideology. Historically, religion has offered a form of understanding of the nature of violence and rage, and then seeks solutions to resolve the issues leading otherwise to cruel behavior. This was traditionally done within the congregations, and they could serve this function again. At a national level, those truly vital religions and spiritual traditions not plagued with intolerance and hatred might have an enormous impact in curing many social ills, including the disease of irrational religious dogmatism that has been a major cause of violence. And then we have the violence towards our veterans. I've produced 4 separate documentaries about the plight of veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and Gulf War syndrome. Never before are we finding so many homeless veterans. I have found thousands living throughout the woods in northeast Florida and in the Arizona desert and in California in the woods. They're everywhere, but almost always out of sight. They have no food, electricity, medicine, or beds, no toilet, no running water. I've spoken with hundreds of homeless men and women, almost all of whom told me that they were victims of violence. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder due to the violence they inflicted or witnessed on others during combat. Similar to gang initiates, these vets underwent indoctrination. Worse, many were heavily medicated with cocktails of drugs while in the combat zones. This deadly combination of pharmaceutical drugs and mind-altering indoctrination methods transforms good soldiers, good people, into the fools of conquest and destruction, and ultimately their own. One woman told me that she never imagined it would be possible in her lifetime, after serving in combat, to find how violated she had become when she became a homeless vet. There was no empathy, no compassion for her. This is what enables soldiers to destroy homes and terrorize families during night raids. She said she had gone into the military, but she had been conditioned to be desensitized. She was anesthetized to the suffering of others. After completing her military commitment and returning home, she became volatile towards her spouse and children. 3 months later, she herself was homeless, without friends, family, food, or money. During the following months, she had been harassed, beaten, raped, until she heard about groups of veterans living in the woods. Now she and others, like those in this struggle to survive, rely upon their military skills and being around other military personnel in the woods. The moment these veterans enter a town to get their daily bread and perhaps find clean water to wash and to drink, the local residents make their disdain towards them clear. In the past, when I have asked veterans how they feel when Glenn Beck or Sean Hannity bark about supporting our troops and their feelings about Bush and Obama, the generals, the VA, the corporate media refusing to confront this national disgrace, they have said, "I can speak for every vet I have ever met. Only now do we realize what absolute degenerate hypocrites we as a society have become," end quote. This is another example showing how violence is pervasive, even at the highest level of American culture. And as one said, "You want a real story, Gary? Look at the rape of over 500,000 or sexual abuse of women in the military. None of the perpetrators at the higher level have ever been prosecuted and sent to jail for this. That is violence against women." And that person was correct. Let us not forget child abuse. Why are we not addressing the nation's epidemic of child abuse that ranks highest among all developed nations in the world? According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 6 million children are abused each year. And it doesn't matter what race or religion or socioeconomic or educational level, it's across the board. 5 children, 80% under 4 years of age, die every day of abuse. This is a conservative estimate because an additional 60% of child abuse fatalities go unreported on death certificates. Where's the mourning? Where's the outrage? Where are the headlines? Where's the President of the United States talking about this? Mr. President, as you're talking today, 2,000 children have died in the last 12 months. 2,000. 8,000 children died while you served your first term in office. Show me the reports that you issued to the American people about the suffering of young children under 4. 8,000 died on your watch, sir. You never uttered any word of what we should do about it. Then we have bullying. This is another epidemic. What the Crisis Prevention Institute calls the silent epidemic of children abused, and it's ravaging the country. Special needs children such as Adam Lanza are especially singled out as victims. For example, in October 2009, another young adult with Asperger syndrome, 17-year-old Tyler Long from Maury County, Georgia, was the victim of school bullying. Tyler, however, turned his rage upon himself by committing suicide. Dan Always at the National School Safety Center estimates 2.1 million bullies in the American school system. Bullies. This violent behavior has contributed to almost 300,000 students being physically attacked in secondary schools every month. Approximately 160,000 children every day miss school out of fear and intimidation from bullying threats by other students. Many of our most deluded corporate and political leaders want to blame teachers for the failures of students' learning. The truth is probably closer to the fact that for many children, schools are only dysfunctional care centers for intimidation and maltreatment. Other statistics are more shocking and should make us pause when we consider the Sandy Hook shooting and many other mass killings before it. An estimated 90% of 4th through 8th graders report being victims of bullying. 86% of students believe that victimized students will turn to lethal violence for revenge. 61% of students believe that physical abuse at home is the cause of kids shooting other kids. Also, we have the new violence of cyberbullying. Along with the new technologies, a more interconnected world through telecommunication advances and the internet, bullying is no longer limited to school grounds. Entire organizations are now funded and founded to fight against the rise in cyberbullying that has affected 43% of school children, mostly directed amongst girls. The psychological and emotional traumas from cyberbullying are comparable to real-life bullying because it is easier for a bully to get away with taunting and demeaning another student. In the virtual world, cyberbullying is growing into a serious problem without any certain solutions. Let us not forget Big Pharma. Each of the institutions associated with violence that I just mentioned, private and public, benefit from cruelty. However, two other institutions have contributed directly to most of the indiscriminate mass shootings over the past 20 years. The pharmaceutical industrial complex, including the entire psychiatric establishment and all federal health agencies, particularly the Department of Human Health and Services and the Food and Drug Administration. Is there a direct causal relationship between the epidemic of drug prescriptions for mental health and the rise in mass shootings, such as the latest at Sandy Hook? It is now well established that the majority of teenagers and young adults responsible for mass shootings were taking psychiatric medications for psychological conditions. Physician Dr. Gary Coles has documented numerous student homicides that have been traced to psychotropic drugs. The most frequent medications found in student homicides have been Luvox, Prozac, Paxil, Ritalin, and Zoloft. How can there be almost 100 mass shootings in 20 years, and virtually all the killers have been on psychiatric drugs or within withdrawal stages, and no one at the national level, in the media or government, is willing to have any tie-in association between the two? On January 15th of this year, the Summit on Reducing Gun Violence in America at Johns Hopkins University completed its long deliberations to create a long litany of recommendations for curtailing gun violence. Among the most proposed law changes, there is finally recognition that rules should be tightened for people with mental health problems and to mental health histories with the national instant check system used for gun buyers. However, nowhere are specific medications, especially the selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs that have been most associated with violence to self and others, mentioned and recommended as disqualifying criteria for purchasing a gun. In my opinion, no one on psychiatric meds should be allowed to have a gun, because those are the people who've done most of the shooting, along with gang members, certainly in the mass shootings. It is certain that the Sandy Hook shooter, Adam Lanza, was prescribed one or more medications for treating at least a diagnosis of the Asperger syndrome. There is no single drug ideal for Asperger's. Therefore, a cocktail of psychiatric drugs is frequently prescribed for a variety of symptoms observed in a patient, and these drug combinations can be deadly, and no concise clinical studies have ever been performed to warn us about how these drugs might interact when taken together. It has been the FDA's gross neglect in permitting these dangerous psychotropic drugs to proliferate and reach epidemic proportions as a first course of treating children and teens. Although the Sandy Hook school shooting occurred a month ago, investigating authorities have yet to release details of Adam's medical treatment history. In order to protect the drug industry, which is being cornered by a growing body of scientific evidence confirming these drugs are a serious threat to the country's health and safety, I doubt Adam's drug history will ever see official release. The over-medicating of children is a national disgrace and embarrassment. Nowhere else in the world can you invent illness such as authority defiance disorder and then create a pill to treat it. The entire psychological health of the American population is severely compromised by psychiatry, sitting on national boards, almost every one of them funded by the pharmaceutical industrial complex for the sole purpose of approving and distributing patented drugs for obscene profits. Schools may try to ban aggression, but these are futile efforts if we continue to support and reward the sources that are institutionalized in our national identity. This culture of violence is led by leaders, many of whom are unsympathetic bullies themselves, who are psychologically numb to the mass atrocities inflicted by our foreign policies, blinded by their allegiance to corporate lobbyists who reward them with wealth and means to hold power, and who prefer to remain deaf to the cries of the millions of children in poverty who go hungry or are being physically and psychologically tortured in abusive families and by the social system that doesn't really give a damn about much of other than its own self-preservation. In conclusion, when we investigate all the different forms of violence and their multiple causes, we realize the depth of America's disconnection from the higher values and virtues that sustain and preserve the well-being of all life. Instead, the nation has chosen a path that has digressed into a winner-take-all attitude. The only thing this path nurtures is a cold-hearted disregard towards the pain inflicted upon others. What remains of a national pride has mutated into the perversion of manifest destiny. The consequence has been the emergence of a new caste society that is more representative of medieval India than the vision of the nation's founders. Everything that lives and breathes is a potential commodity for commercial interest. Billions are spent on re-elections, thereby making the vote of citizens irrelevant. Shadow corporate organizations such as ALEC are permitted to operate, meet in secret, to create laws benefiting the profits of its members while harming 98% of Americans. Mainstream corporate media edits the truth because it lacks the conscience to value the truth. Public school teachers are no longer permitted to teach critical thinking skills because this might empower students to become independent, free-thinking adults who might turn out far wiser than elected officials and corporate executives. When the average American family today is too dysfunctional to parent wisely, when children are being programmed to relate better to a virtual reality than to real-life encounters, when inflicting pain is a pleasurable event, when selfishness so permeates society that the thought of helping our neighbor is anathema, then should we be surprised by a shooting occurring at Sandy Hook Elementary School? If we wish to ban assault rifles, then what will be next? Handguns, clubs, knives, a fist, a foot? More violence is perpetrated each year by hands, by fist, by personal violence. Should we not then examine all this? Or how about words fired like bullets into another psyche? What needs to be banned are the causes, the pathologies leading to violence, and those begin at the highest levels of America's economic caste system. In the meantime, we will be unable to engage in an honest dialogue leading to a positive changes if we are unwilling to embrace a higher truth about ourselves and the consequences of our ignorance. I'm Gary Nall, and those are my thoughts. Now, Alex Jones has been vilified as the person who lost it, went ballistic, and indeed he did lose it and go ballistic. But I believe that we have to pull back and listen to what he said, not simply how he said it. Listen in.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it.
The United States is the capital of the world in suicide. It's now our number one cause of violent death, and it's because of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors. On their own inserts say they have an increase in suicide and mass murder type activities, and all of these people that comes out later are on these drugs. I challenge you, if you really want to stop the school shootings, stop giving them so much attention so mentally ill people don't think of it as an option, A, and B, we need to outlaw these serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Alex, can I ask you, do you think you sound rational, the average American?
No, I am awake out of my coma. And the way I act, knowing that people want to come and take my guns and usurp and enslave me, is what a real American would act like. The founding fathers tarred and feathered people. The founding fathers beat people to death that try to take their guns. The founding fathers shot people that try to take their guns, and we hail them as the paragons of liberty. I'm not calling for any of that, okay? I'm not one-tenth as radical as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and people like that. I am verbally saying, hey, more guns equals massively less crime. That is the point that I'm getting at. If the government was only coming after my Second Amendment, I wouldn't be as worried. But I happen to know that eugenicists, globalists, run our government now, and they have a plan to bankrupt our country under Agenda 21. And I think that this has benefited the larger debate, and I think it shows that some Americans are threatened by somebody being angry and focused, shows that America is in a trance. America has become passive with drone killings and secret arrest and NDAA and banker bailouts and Wall Street corruption. And it's time to get a pulse again. As Howard Beale said in Network, it's time to get mad. It's time to say, I'm a human being, God damn it. My life has value. I want you to go to the window. I want you to stick your head out. And I want you to say, I'm as mad as hell. And I'm not going to take this anymore. My life has value. A lot of people say, you know, just leave us alone. I don't care about the inflation and the Russians and the shootings and the crime in the streets. Just leave us alone. Let us have our steel-belted radios and our toasted and our TiVo and our iPads, and leave us alone in our living rooms. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I want you to realize the American dream is becoming a nightmare and our liberties are being systematically eradicated. Major universities call us one of the worst police states in the world. They're openly trying to curtail internet freedom. Even mainstream news admits that. We're losing our liberties. Global megabanks are exempt from all the laws they foist on us. The offshore megabanks don't even hardly pay taxes, but lobby to raise taxes on us here domestically so that they can simply extract our wealth out in corporate welfare. Learn about the New World Order. Learn about the globalists, now they fund fascist, communist, and socialist. Anything that's centralized. Learn about eugenics and the cancer viruses and the vaccines. Learn about the GMO designed to sterilize you. Learn. I mean, I've got John P. Holdren's own book right here. Hell, let me show it to you right here.
All right, Alex. I think that's about...
They put poison in the water. Poison in the water. This is a normal response to this. This is how they should have responded to Hitler.
I do like how this now sounds like a WWF promo, but I think we're going to have to let it go there. Thank you, Alex, so much for joining us.
We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Just imagine in our society, if only 10% of Americans could become angry and outraged by our complicities, by a military-industrial complex, by the bailout of the bankers, by the corrupt political process that buys elections, by keeping people working at slave labor. How long do you think it would be before we force change? But if we're afraid of being angry because of what it would represent and our passion to stay always removed, then maybe it's time that we heard more people yelling at us and then deciding, is there any sense or is it all nonsense? My guest standing by, sorry, it's going to be a short interview. Part of it will be on our regular program, and then we'll continue on our internet all over the world, is John Rappaport. John has been a high-quality reporter for over 30 years, investigative journalist, and he explores corporatocracy, alternative health, and medical cartels. And he has published in Stern, Village Voice, Spin Magazine, LA Weekly, CBS Health Watch, etc. And he runs a website with many years of research and articles called NoMoreFakeNews.com. Nice to have you with us today, John. Hi, John?
Yes, I'm here, Gary. Thank
Hi,
you.
John.
Unfortunately, as I told your producer, I have to get off in 5 minutes, but I'm going to try to boil down a few things for you.
Take any of the things that we have discussed today in my commentary on gun control and our national passion to stay, in effect, removed from the consequences of our actions. Take any part of that and give us your input, please.
Well, you know, listening to your commentary, one of the things that stayed with me throughout is the idea of trying to solve these problems for a nation of 15-20 million people historically doesn't seem to work out. In other words, decentralization of power has to be very high on the agenda, where people actually not only feel but are participating in their own future on a political, economic, and every other level, social level, where there is community, where the politicians aren't so remote, where the Pentagon isn't so remote, where the CIA isn't so remote, where the black budget isn't so remote, where the imperial empire building isn't so remote, where people can go about their local business and decide their own fate among their own communities without having to salute every federal law and regulation that comes down the pipeline, of which there are thousands and millions. And if there is any faith to be put in the American people themselves, it comes from the idea that in a decentralized state where people actually have political control over their lives at a local level and don't have to stand up and salute everything the federal government does. They can make their own decisions, their own laws. They can look each other in the eye when they do it and know that there is accountability. Whereas now, as you've laid out here, you know, the superstructure that we're talking about at the top of this society is so remote, so powerful, so much a juggernaut, so full of lies and deceptions and insanity and criminality and murder. How in the world is somebody who's living on a little farm somewhere in the state of Washington going to think that he has a chance of affecting the superstructure unless the agenda is decentralization? And you know, as an outrageous example, there are several counties in California that have decided to ban GMO crops, not label the products, but ban the crops. Marin, for example, they decided to act locally. Okay, nobody can grow GMOs in this county now. That's it. Well, suppose the same county, Marin, or some other county, or even a small town said, nobody can prescribe SSRI antidepressants in this town. Otherwise, they go to jail for 10 years. That's it. Forget it. We don't care what the federal government says. We're not taking federal money. We don't care what they say. now you have, yes, it's just like fanning a little tiny spark, but you have the beginning of the possibility of decentralization of power away from these lunatics and killers and liars, putting it in the hands of people who know each other, who live in the same place, who now have to be responsible for the consequences of what they enact as the destiny of their own lives. That, to me, was my primary reaction to listening to, you know, the litany of causes of violence that you laid out completely in your commentary, that it, to believe that we can somehow solve this on a national level and force these people. Yes, we have to try, no question about it. I'm not giving up, but we have to decentralize. It has to happen. And where it happens, we have to encourage it and learn from it. So that would be my major response right off the top of my head to everything that you've been saying here. By the way, I love the clips intercutting Alex and Howard Beale.
Howard Beale from Network.
Yeah.
John, we're out of time. I'm going to invite you back based upon an article I read of yours recently where you spoke with a man who was obviously associated with a big pharma who talked about going after anyone in the AIDS community who denied the virtue of the single virus theory and the dirty tricks that were played behind the scenes, including on Peter Duesberg. This is brand new, never before revealed information that there was a whole black op operation going on, well orchestrated. And I want to have you back to tell that story of how
they
went after any and all dissident scientists, all right?
Yes, absolutely, Gary.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Gary.
John Rappaport from San Diego, and his website is nomorefakenews.com. He'll be back for full discussion on the people working in Big Pharma behind the scenes to make sure that any doctor, any scientist, any activist who challenged the HIV equals AIDS orthodoxy would be crucified, and how they did it, the man who was a part of it, John interviewed, and we'll get that story. We're out of time for this segment of our program, and I want to thank you all for listening and look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now, we're going to do our final segment here on TalkBack. We're going to take your calls. Our number is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Knoll, and standing by is Luann Panessi, and as we get your calls, we'll go to them. Let's go to Luann Panessi first. Hi, Luann. Luann, you're on. We have Luann there? No? Okay. I will wait a moment and see if anyone else would like to call in and share their points of view. And because not often I do such an intense and long commentary, but I felt it was necessary not to take any shortcuts and to point to everything that is involved. Assault weapons, I believe we shouldn't have, but I also believe that we have every right to have handguns and rifles. Let's say hello. Is Luann there? Luann, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Gary. Sorry about that.
We'll have Roy on tomorrow, but you're on now.
Okay. I got someone here from, his name is just G here. It says, Gary, we used to see a few celebrities such as Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, Sting, Bob Geldof, and Bono that were using their name, fame, and money to bring attention, funding, and real positive change to the serious environmental, political, and financial issues in the United States and around the planet. That was mostly in the 1990s, and it kind of fizzled out around 2000. And his question is, why are there so few major and minor celebrities that have ever stepped forward to help bring money, attention, and change to the countless worthy causes around the planet?
Well, your question begs several issues. First, we have to step back from the assumption that because a person's a celebrity, that they should use their celebrity to help others. The vast majority never will do that. Whether they master their craft to our desire or not, when we go into a theater, a Broadway play, or watch them on television, that's a performance. They're giving us a performance, and we're giving them our respect by watching a man giving money. There is no caveat that says, oh, by the way, if you are a celebrity, an artist, you must also be a social activist for some cause. Then we would have to hold the same standard to every politician, same standard to every religious leader, same standard to every citizen, and we don't. In fact, there's only a tiny, tiny percentage of under one-tenth of 1% of the population that ever has become proactive on any issue. So we are not an activist nation, though it may seem like that at times. Like we weren't a sexual revolution nation. At the height of the sexual revolution, only 3% of the gay or heterosexuals participated. But because we focused so much energy on it, everyone else who was not a part of it became passive spectators to it. Now, also, there have been celebrities, historically, who have given a lot of their time, energy, and effort, like Susan Sarandon or Tim Robbins or Sean Penn or others, irrespective of their political belief, to different causes. Now, whether they're right or wrong on giving it is secondary to the fact that they did give it. Now, but that also means that not all causes last forever. What if you were part of an environmental cause of helping clean up the water, but no matter what you did, it never got cleaned up? There were always some countermeasures to stop that. At a certain point, you may want to give up and say, okay, I've done it. We'll turn it over to other people. I put in my time. And you hope that someone else comes along and picks it up. Now, there are specific causes, like getting an innocent man out of jail, where you have people lend their celebrity, helping raise money, pay for the defense fund. And that's the cause they participate in. And without some of those people, including Peter Jackson, the maker of the Hobbit and the trilogy of the Lord of the Ring trilogy, there's no question that the three innocent men who were convicted as young boys of killing the children, they didn't do it. But without his money to get them the forensic experts and get them the help, that truth would never have come out. The real DNA would never come out. And the real criminal was highlighted in the documentary I just saw it a couple weeks ago. West of Memphis, that I highly recommend people to watch. West of Memphis is the documentary it showed. But there were several celebrities that lent their time, energy, effort, and their resources. I commend them for that. Now, the fact that they may never engage in anything else, or might, is irrelevant. They did something. They did something important. I only hope that people find some cause that they can align themselves with in a meaningful way and support it. But we are not an activist nation. By the way, I want to thank everyone for spreading the word about the war on health. It's free. It's up on the Internet. Share that with people. I'm getting figures as high as 30 million people watching it. Give it to other people. The more people watch it, the more they're going to become educated. And the more educated they are, the more action they will take. Also, this commentary today will be posted in about an hour on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNall.com. Please share it with other people. Share the one that's up there currently on the vaccine myth or about the flu vaccine being effective. Share that. Send it around to everyone you know. That's how we work in the progressive field. We share important information with each other, and that it qualifies to help a cause. And that's the bottom line to it all. Thank you, Luann Panessi. Let's now say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're going to be talking about the Barack Obama's gun control plan. And then listeners are going to engage in a new feature we introduced last week called On Point, where they debate each other. And the subject today is civil rights or human rights.
Great. I look forward to it. Have a nice
Me
show.
Me too.
You please lead coming right now. Have a nice day, everyone. Mm-hmm.